I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court decision that made abortion legal until viability, has been under attack ever since it became the law of the land back in 1973. The same goes for Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which in 1992 upheld Roe, but with restrictions as long as they did not create an undue burden for a woman seeking an abortion. Yesterday, the court heard a challenge to Roe and to Casey, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. It's a Mississippi law that would ban abortion after 15 weeks, except if there's a medical emergency or a, quote, severe fetal abnormality. There are no exceptions for rape and incest. The issues before the Supreme Court involved precedent, autonomy, liberty, and viability, which is between 22 and 24 weeks, and whether pre-viability elective abortions could be unconstitutional. Today on Radio Times, what is the future for Roe and Casey and the right to an abortion? Michael Moreland joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. He is a professor of law and religion, director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy at Villanova University's Charles Widger School of Law. And Michael Moreland, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from California is Catherine Colbert. She's the attorney who argued before the Supreme Court Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which is credited with saving Roe v. Wade. She's the co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights, director of the Athena Center for Leadership at Barnard College, and wrote a book with Julie Kay, which came out this summer. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about it, titled Controlling Women, What We Must Do to Save Reproductive Freedom. And Catherine Colbert, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So let me just begin with an overall question. And, I've read a lot of things, basically a lot of reporters and legal people reading the tea leaves from yesterday. And I'll start with you, Catherine Colbert. Is Roe v. Wade on the chopping block?
Yes. As far as I'm concerned, I think given what we know about this current court and nothing that led me to a different belief yesterday, I think Roe versus Wade will be dead within the year. And I think one of the problems is the press keeps reporting this as, well, it could be totally overturned, or you could uphold the 15-week ban and not do more, as if that is a different thing. In fact, both results are overturning Roe and Casey, because both of those decisions allowed abortions up until the point of viability. So if you uphold a 15-week ban, no matter how you do it, you are effectively overruling both Roe and Casey. And I think it's really important for us not to make that distinction, because it's not an easy out for kind of that Justice Roberts type of justice. In fact, he is overruling Roe if he upholds the 15-week ban.
Let me get a response from you, Michael Moreland. As you listened and heard the arguments yesterday, what was your takeaway?
I think that's right, what Ms. Colbert says. I think that Mississippi is almost certainly going to prevail, that the law will be upheld. The question is, will the court do so by expressly overruling Roe and Casey and returning the issue entirely to the states and the people, or will, as she suggests, will there be something like a decision to basically rework Casey, which itself was a reworking of Roe, and say that up to 15 weeks there's enough time for a woman to make that decision? The Chief Justice asked some questions that kind of went in that direction, and basically come up with a new test or a new application of undue burden that in many ways I think would be as unworkable as the Roe Casey regime has been.
So it sounds like you're both seeing this from a similar point of view. Let me play Mississippi Solicitor General. This is Scott Stewart's opening statement. This is yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court, just so our listeners can hear what he had to say.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions. They've damaged the democratic process. They've poisoned the law. They've choked off compromise. For 50 years, they've kept this court at the center of a political battle that it can never resolve. And 50 years on, they stand alone. Nowhere else does this court recognize a right to end a human life.
Catherine Colbert, what do you say in response to Solicitor General Scott Stewart's opening statement?
Well, you know, Again, Marty, the position of the state is that for some reason returning it to the states allows compromise. Ultimately, what that only allows is for states to replace individual women as decision makers. It allows states to ban abortion. And in fact, in my view, it's likely that as many as 26 states will ban abortion within the year should the court or when the court overturns Roe and Casey. And so I think that this whole notion of compromise is just crazy. The reality is that the compromise is providing constitutional protection, which leaves these decisions in the hands of individual women who make judgments based on their own life circumstances and based on their own medical needs. And to say that allowing government or allowing politicians to control women's decision-making, relegating them to unequal status in society, in my view, is not a compromise. It's a political fix that, frankly, is extraordinarily damaging for women's health and well-being.
Well, speaking of political, let me play one more clip, and then, Michael, I'll give you a chance to respond. And this is Justice Sonia Sotomayor pointing out that abortion rights is, frankly, a longstanding precedent, and she worried that it could be viewed as a political decision if the court rules against Roe.
The right of a woman to choose, the right of to control her own body, has been clearly set for since Casey and never challenged. You want us to reject that line of viability and adopt something different. 15 justices over 50 years have, or I should say 30 since Casey, have reaffirmed that basic viability line. Four have said no, two of them members of this court, but 15 justices have said yes, of varying political backgrounds. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
And that is a quote that's gotten a lot of play. I think her use of the word stench. But nonetheless, Michael Moreland, what do you say in response to what Justice Sotomayor was just saying?
Well, and also in somewhat in response to what Ms. Colbert said, I mean, abortion is a hard issue for a lot of reasons, legally and morally. One of them is that there is, on the one hand, the interests of women in bodily integrity and autonomy, but it is a unique issue because there is another human life at stake, and that's the life of the unborn child. And so states like Mississippi want to strike that balance in a way through the democratic process that is more favorable to protecting unborn children than other states will. And that's the regime that would be left after Roe and Casey if they were to fall. And honestly, I mean, Justice Sotomayor, I think overstates first, I think, the fallout from it, because this will mean that states can strike the balance in different ways in different kinds of states. And frankly, the stench has mostly been from the unworkability of the Roe-Casey regime for 50 years and the fact that the court has been the kind of national medical board of abortion regulation for 50 years, and that has not worked out very well.
You want to respond to that, Catherine Colbert?
Yeah, 2 points here, Marty. First is, you know, while I respect the views of those who oppose us on this issue that they consider fetal life to be unborn children, religions of the world differ significantly on this question, many of which say that, in fact, abortion is warranted and appropriate in many circumstances. So in my view, it is politicians imposing their philosophical or religious views on everyone else. Not everyone believes what our opponents do. And so I think it's really important to strike a balance for individual liberty, not for politicians' view of this circumstance. And second, when Justice Sotomayor talks about stench, I absolutely agree with her. Why? Because the appointments to the Supreme Court have become so political in recent years, beginning with the battles where arch conservatives were being put on the court for the purpose of overruling Roe, for the purpose of defeating gay marriage and a variety of other right-wing issues that are really what I call wedge issues politically. And that was what the court addressed in Casey. The Casey decision in upholding Roe, in ensuring that stare decisis remain, was very aware of the problems with attacking the institutional integrity of the court by making rulings that have no basis in fact, no change in the law, did not reflect the operative legal standards. And I think when, let me just say real quickly, sure, Marty, when there is a precedent that has been reaffirmed so many times, it should not just get normal weight, but heightened weight. It shouldn't be reversed because the perception of the public is that it is, as Justice Sotomayor claimed, only because of the changing personnel on the court, not the changing rule of law.
And a lot was made, Michael Moreland, of the fact that this is precedent. If it's Roe, we're talking about 50 years. If it's Casey, it's 30 years. Others have talked about the importance of precedents when they're candidates being considered for the U.S. Supreme Court. But if you're both right, and Roe is basically deemed, what, unconstitutional or taken away, you're taking away a right. 25% of women in this country have had an abortion. How unusual is it to remove a right versus confer a right when it comes to precedent?
Well, that came up yesterday, and there was a battle back and forth about, you know, prior precedents that have been overruled. The court has clearly many times overruled its precedents. I mean, most famously, when Brown versus Board of Education overruled Plessy versus Ferguson. But you're right, the counter argument to that was made that, well, but that was, you know, conferring a right,
exactly,
or changing the law, the baseline in a way. But I do think that the majority, that I think six justices of the court believe that Roe was wrong the day it was decided and Casey was wrong the day it was decided as well. The question of whether they'll, again, as I said earlier, expressly overrule them, I think is still hanging over this case. But again, it allows the political process, as it has in Europe, as it has in other countries around the world, it allows the political process to kind of strike a balance between women's rights, the rights of unborn children, in a way that takes this, that kind of wicks away the political pressure that the court arrogated to itself in 1973 and has failed to kind of bring the country together as they said they wanted to in Casey. But the fact, as Ms. Colbert says, the fact that Supreme Court nominations, Senate elections, presidential elections have become so focused on this issue is because of the way the court has handled it for 50 years.
Well, we are talking about the future of Roe v. Wade, and our guests are Michael Moreland and Catherine Colbert. It's an issue that was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday involving a Mississippi abortion law. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking about the future of abortion rights. We're talking about the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court heard this week, and in fact heard yesterday, involving Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. And our guests are Villanova Law Professor Michael Moreland and Catherine Colbert, public interest attorney who argued the landmark case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, in 1992 before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Let me make sure you can as well. You can email us at RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at phone numbers 1-888-477-9499. Catherine Colbert, let me go back to you. And if abortion is banned, essentially, or it's up to the states, and some states could ban it, and some, frankly, could keep it probably pretty close to what Roe was some 50 years ago, would that criminalize abortion? So if a woman living in a state that essentially banned an abortion, banned abortions, that if she went to get one illegally, that would be a crime that she would have committed?
Possibly, Marty. That would depend on the state law. In my view, it's likely that 26 states will ban abortion at some point. and have varying degrees of both criminal penalties and, as Texas did, civil penalties, which probably are more onerous than any criminal penalties, in that it allows any vigilante to sue for $10,000 to not just the abortion provider, but anyone who helps a woman to get an abortion in violation of the act. So, yes, the states will vary, but the result will be the same for women. And I think what we're not talking about in all of this is what happens to women when you ban abortion. And what happens is they suffer dramatic health problems. They have to travel hundreds of miles to the safe states. There's probably 15 of those, mostly located on the coast, although Kansas is a good destination, kind of middle of the country. It means that they will be seeking a medication abortion, which is a very safe result, but again subjecting themselves possibly to criminal penalties just for getting the drug, not for having the abortion. Other women will carry unintended pregnancies to term against their will. And I think that those ramifications not only affect women's health, but their economic sustenance in the world, their ability to participate equally in society. And I think that the whole point of all of this is that their individual autonomy, their individual bodily integrity is dramatically curtailed. And we need to focus on women here because they bear the brunt of these punitive laws.
Well, Michael Moreland, picking up on that and going back to you, can a state then force a woman to have a baby against her will?
I don't know of any serious pro-life proposals post-Roe that would criminalize abortion as to the women seeking them. Most of the laws, including the Mississippi law here, imposes sanctions on clinics and doctors that perform illegal abortions. And so I think that's likely where the legislative landscape will play out. And again, I think that that's as it should be, so that we can strike political compromises in different parts of the country. Some states are more conservative. Some states are more liberal. States like New York and Illinois and California have already proactively enacted statutes that legalize abortion up to birth, even if Roe versus Wade should be overturned. Other states obviously will be more restrictive about it. But that's, again, because they want to strike the balance between the woman's right and the right of the unborn child in a way that's more responsive politically to trying to, you know, compromise on that very, very difficult issue.
But would you agree that frankly, poor women will be hurt by this because they're not going to be able to go to New York or California if they live, let's say, in Texas or in Mississippi?
Well, and I'm sure Ms. Colbert would be quick to point out that in a lot of those states, they have a hard time getting abortion as it is now because of restrictions that are somewhat already in place, and also because of lack of interest in doctors in performing abortions in the first place. But again, that's because we live in a federal system where different states will want to come to different answers on this, and the nationalizing of the question as a constitutional matter in the Supreme Court has been the problem for 50 years.
Let me play another clip, and then Catherine Colbert, I'll go to you. This is the U.S. Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar. I got her name, I think, correct, responding to an early question about why women would need more than 15 weeks to get an abortion. Let's hear her answer.
So the question is, why would women need access to abortion after 15 weeks, and what is the effect on them? And there are any number of women who cannot get an abortion earlier. They don't realize that they're pregnant. That's especially true of women who are young or don't haven't experienced a pregnancy before, or their life circumstances change, as you referred to, Justice Sotomayor. They lose their job, or their relationship breaks apart, or they have medical complications. Or for many women, they don't have the resources to pay for it earlier. It takes time for them to raise the money or make the appropriate logistical arrangements to be able to take time off work and travel and have childcare. And for all those women in this category who need access to abortion after 15 weeks, the fact that other women were able to exercise their constitutional rights does nothing to diminish the impact on their liberty interests in forcing them to continue with that pregnancy.
Catherine Colbert, you're the attorney that argued Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Is that not an undue burden that she just described there?
I think it is. Any ban on women before viability is an undue burden. That's what Casey said. Let's be clear here. Most abortions are performed in the first trimester, 90%. Of the other 10% of abortions, most are performed before 15 weeks. But one of the categories that the Solicitor General did not talk about is women with wanted pregnancies who find themselves suffering health problems or carrying pregnancies with severe fetal anomalies in which those pregnancies will not survive birth. And to subject, let me just give you an example, a woman in Ireland who became the rallying cry for the movement in Ireland faced a wanted pregnancy, found herself in need of an abortion at, I think it was, you know, like 18 or 20 weeks. She died because the ban on abortion in Ireland said she couldn't have an abortion there. She suffered sepsis because they detected, quote unquote, a fetal heartbeat, wouldn't perform the abortion, and she died. And, you know, unfortunately, Marty, in the days before Roe, women died with unintended pregnancies because of the bans on abortion. Now, I think that will be less often today because of the availability of medication abortion and the gray and black market for those drugs. But at the same time, it seems to me we shouldn't have to wait for women to suffer irreparable harm, a loss of their fertility, a loss of their autonomy, in order to make the point that these laws are bad and shouldn't be on the books.
Michael, hold on, because I want to get Marie from Wayne to join our conversation, then I'll give you a chance to respond. And Marie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I wanted to comment on the women who are going to be forced into back alley abortions. I'm looking at the death certificate of my great-grandmother as we speak. She died on October 18th, 1918. The family lore was that she had died in the Spanish flu epidemic, pregnant with her fifth child. The death certificate indicates that a primary cause of death was septicemia, and the contributory cause was, and I'm reading this, I'm quoting this, abortion induced by the patient. She left a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, my grandfather being the 14-year-old, motherless. I haven't heard any discussion about the orphans that are going to be left behind, and I think this is going to be the next Underground Railroad. Women are going to be finding routes to be able to get to abortion providers.
Marie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give you a chance, Michael Moreland. I'm sure Catherine Colbert, you want to respond as well, but go ahead.
Just on the issue about the Solicitor General's comment about the 15 weeks, my point in response to that is it proves too much because she wants to insist, as do those on the pro-choice side, on this viability line. But why does the woman's interest, if that's the argument, stop at viability? Why not the same considerations that the Solicitor General pointed out about wanting an abortion after 15 weeks? And by the way, the Mississippi statute does have an exception for medical emergencies, for maternal-fetal conflict and fetal abnormalities. But why doesn't that same set of considerations apply in the 25th week or the 30th week or the 35th week of pregnancy? And again, it's because this viability line was arbitrarily drawn up by Justice Blackmun back in Roe and then reaffirmed in Casey. And it just isn't a workable way of administering abortion regulation.
Let me give you a chance to respond, Catherine Colbert, to what Marie was saying about her great-grandmother dying from a self-induced abortion. Are you concerned if there are states that are going to essentially make abortion illegal, that women will resort to that?
Yes, I am very concerned. I think we are better off from the days before Roe only because of the availability of medication abortion if taken early in pregnancy, which is up to about 10 weeks, you can take some pills to self-induce an abortion. And I do think that there will be a gray and black market for those drugs in states where abortion is illegal. But, you know, my grandmother died in childbirth as well, not as a result of an abortion. But remember that childbirth is very dangerous. And when you criminalize abortion, it becomes more dangerous. And yes, the ramifications for families are intense. They're really, really real. That is, I think those who oppose abortion want to always say, well, if this is just a political compromise. Well, for a woman who suffers infertility as a result of bad medical care or not being able to get an abortion when she needs it, or for a woman who suffers severe health consequences, that's not a compromise that's appropriate, right? This is a real event in her life, and I think we need to remember that and remember that women are the whole point of these laws. Too often, as we said in the book we wrote, Controlling Women, is this is about misogyny. It's about controlling women and making sure that they can't exercise appropriate judgments for their own lives.
Let me go back to you, Michael Moreland, something that Catherine Colbert said, which is that if it's going to get harder and harder to have an abortion at an abortion clinic, women will use drugs and they'll have it delivered to their home. As you said, the way the laws are written now, it's the doctors that would be essentially arrested or having to sort of pay the price for having done an illegal abortion. If a woman is doing this herself and there's no doctor involved, do we hold her criminally liable?
Well, I don't think that would be a wise course as a matter of if I were a state legislator, I don't think that would be a wise course to pursue. But I want to say that obviously I'm moved by the caller's comment about her great grandmother. I do think it's incumbent on the pro-life movement, which is, I think, on the cusp of this tremendous victory, at the same time to be cognizant of the need to support women and their babies, to provide care and health care during pregnancy, after pregnancy, and to have a range of solutions to this problem of women who are in these situations, but at the same time understanding that there's another human life at stake here, and that it's fair and proper for, I think, the states and the political process to be able to recognize that unborn child's right to life as well.
I've done so many of these shows, and I'm not trying to be naive here, but Catherine Colbert, let me go back to you, because I did interview you about the book that you co-authored this summer about entitled Controlling Women, but you do come up with something that you think many people can agree on, including probably someone like Michael Moreland: reducing maternal and infant deaths, better sex education, affordable child care and pre-care, family-friendly work benefits, better fairness for pregnant workers, reducing sexual abuse and violence. I mean, almost feels like such an intractable issue. Is there any common ground left, or was there ever common ground?
Well, I would hope so, Marty, because, for me, the reproductive rights at stake here are much broader than just abortion. They're about making decisions about sexuality, about marriage and family, about parenting, and ensuring that all people can become parents. And it seems to me the social supports for parents ought to be things that both sides can agree on. Unfortunately, this issue on the other side has meant that isn't the case. I mean, I spent years of my life fighting for many of those social supports and not getting a lot of help from those who oppose abortion. So I think that, yes, theoretically, that should be the case. Mm-hmm. But because the Republican Party has become so focused on abortion, they don't want to give an inch on supporting family-friendly policies. I mean, let's look at the Build Back Better plan that President Biden has supported. In there is child care, help for maternal and infant deaths, greater educational opportunities for women early in pregnancy and early childhood education, child care benefits, and they've opposed all of that. So while I do think that theoretically, yes, you are correct, and I would hope we could reach compromise on those family-friendly policies, the Republican Party is not going there, and they have opposed them across the board.
How about for you, Michael Moreland? And let's just pull out contraception. I mean, can we come together on that?
Yes, I think so. And, it's a long, complicated story about how the pro-life movement became so associated with the Republican Party. In fact, interestingly, I think in 1970, if you'd had to place bets about what party would be the home of the pro-life movement, you would have said the Democratic Party. It was home of a lot of Catholic voters who tended to be pro-life. People like Ted Kennedy were very strongly pro-life back in the 1970s. And then again, for complicated reasons, the pro-life movement became yoked to the Republican Party. And Ms. Colbert and I have some common ground here. I think that unfortunately, often Republicans are much too wary of social support legislation and family support legislation and ways of providing for mothers and their babies that I think would be a kind of common ground in a post-Roe world.
Let me read a bunch of comments and then we'll take another break. We've got some more clips and more conversation. Betty says, I'm very frustrated that the same people who want to do away with Roe v. Wade are also the people who defend gun rights and don't do anything about people killing people. A comment from James, the stench on the court really started with the underhanded appointment of the last two justices. A comment from Conrad, you played Mississippi opening statement from the Solicitor General saying nowhere else does the Constitution recognize the right to take a life, quote, and no one gave any pushback on this yesterday in the oral argument. While a little tangential to the central issue in the case, the Second Amendment right to self-defense is obviously a right to take a life as we see all the time. One more comment, one from Kate. I wish the people that want to end abortion rights would start paying attention to what happens with unplanned pregnancies after the children are born. They don't seem to support policies that support children or mothers. Well, we are talking about abortion today on Radio Times because yesterday there were arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court involving a Mississippi potential law that would ban abortion after 15 weeks. And again, our guests are Catherine Colbert. She's a public interest attorney. She argued the landmark case Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992 before the U.S. Supreme Court. Also with us, Villanova Law Professor Michael Moreland. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with our guests about the future of abortion rights and some of the arguments heard yesterday before the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's Justice Kavanaugh, and he is summing up Mississippi Solicitor General's argument that because the Constitution was, quote, silent on abortion, the Supreme Court should also be neutral and left to the states to decide the future of abortion. We'll also hear from Julie Rinkelman, and she is from the Center for Reproductive Rights, the attorney representing that organization.
And I think they also then continue, because the Constitution is neutral, that this court should be scrupulously neutral on the question of abortion, neither pro-choice nor pro-life. But because they say the Constitution doesn't give us the authority, we should leave it to the states and we should be scrupulously neutral on the question. And that they are saying here, I think, that we should return to a position of neutrality on that contentious social issue rather than continuing to pick sides on that issue. So I think that's, at a big picture level, their argument. I want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yes, a few points, if I may, Your Honor. First, of course, those very same arguments were made in Casey, and the court rejected them, saying that this philosophical disagreements can't be resolved in a way that a woman has no choice in the matter. And second, I don't think it would be a neutral position. The Constitution provides a guarantee of liberty. The court has interpreted that liberty to include the ability to make decisions related to childbearing, marriage, and family. Women have an equal right to liberty under the Constitution, Your Honor, and if they're not able to make this decision, if states can take control of women's bodies and force them to endure months of pregnancy and childbirth, then they will never have equal status under the Constitution.
Catherine Colbert, again, you argued Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Anything you want to say to that? And we'll also hear from Michael Moreland.
Well, I agree with Julie's position here. It's absolutely true that the Constitution isn't neutral on this question. It provides for liberty. And it has been interpreted as early as kind of the early 1900s of providing for the ability of individuals to make important decisions about their life, whether it is you know, controlling the education of their children or making autonomous decisions related to their body. The irony of all of this is, you know, the public debate about bodily integrity has really come to bear around vaccines.
Yeah, I know.
Those who oppose us on abortion have been screaming and yelling about how horrible this is to get a vaccine that can save their health. And an interference with the right to control their own bodies in a circumstance which obviously not getting a vaccine jeopardizes other people. But in this instance, when it's women who want to ensure the ability to control their own bodies, they're dead set against it. And I think that irony just is one more reason why the Constitution ought to protect individuals to make decisions about their lives, particularly when it doesn't have a health effect on anyone else.
You want to respond to that, Michael Moorman?
Well, it's not my view. I think states have the power to enforce vaccine mandates, just as I think states have the power to protect unborn human life. And so my position, at least for what it's worth, is I think reasonably consistent on that. On the constitutional point, I understand Ms. Colbert's position, and she ably argued it in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, but I just think that the majority of the court is convinced correctly that when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, that liberty, as it's understood in the 14th Amendment, had no wise an understanding that it included a right to abortion. And that's the problem of Roe, that's the problem of Casey, and that, I think, is the error that's going to be corrected.
Let me get Allison from
I think it's really a disservice to force us to go back to what the current state of the law was at the time of the passage of the 14th Amendment, when in fact abortion was legal and available at the time that the Constitution was drafted. And the whole point here is not what it was like in the past, but where we want it to be now. And in my view, the notions of liberty have changed over the centuries of this country. Gay marriage wasn't recognized when the 14th Amendment was passed either, and that shouldn't mean it shouldn't be recognized as a constitutional right. So I think we need to begin to think about the Constitution in a way that is expansive of individual liberties as much as we can.
And let me just add to that, just from Pew has looked at sort of where Americans stand when it comes to abortion, and a majority, not a huge majority, but something like 60% of Americans think it should be legal, probably with some restrictions, just to put that out there. Let me get Allison to join us. And Allison, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thanks. I'd like to talk specifically to Michael Moorman because he apparently thinks his morality applies to everyone else's lives. I would like to know what you would have had me do when I was when I had just graduated from grad school about 6 years ago. I was interviewing for jobs, professional jobs, but I had none. I was broke. I was pregnant with the baby of a partner who I broke up with, who broke up with me a year later. We couldn't get together the $400 for an abortion. So I'm not exactly sure how I would have supported myself. The job that I eventually got was working outside in a physical job. Also, I was on a drug that frequently causes babies to be born without skulls. Hmm. Now, what should I have done there? If I lived in a state where some random other people got to choose for me from their morality, what should I have done?
Allison, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Michael Moorman.
Well, I'm sorry for that situation. And as I was saying earlier, there are a lot of these difficult situations that I understand women find themselves in. And that's why I think we can find common ground, as we were saying earlier, about ways of supporting mothers and their babies. and we can have access to health care. And, you know, in a lot of these contexts, we're not talking about, you know, absolute bans from the time of conception on. I mean, even the Mississippi statute allows pregnancy allows abortion up to 15 weeks. And those are the compromises, again, that I think have to be struck. And just one little footnote, Marty, you talked about the polling data.
Yeah.
But the polling data it's conflicted. So you ask people straight up, do they support Roe versus Wade? A majority says yes. But you ask people, do they support restrictions on abortion in circumstance X, circumstance Y, circumstance Z? And people, and for the most part, majorities in parts of the country say that they do. And it is odd that the pro-choice movement seems to think that they command majority support, but yet think that they need the Supreme Court to resolve this issue. If they're confident in majority support, then they should allow this process to play out in the states or in Congress. We could have federal legislation on this one way or the other, and get the Supreme Court out of it.
Well, let me give you a chance, Catherine Colbert, to respond to that.
Well, if, in fact, state legislatures were reflective of public's views, I would be amenable to that. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. And, you know, I think 2 points here. Most importantly, there are about 900,000, almost a million women a year who get abortions. And all of those stories are different. And all of those stories reflect the needs of individuals who are facing all kinds of life circumstances. And to say it's a compromise to allow a state to say their view, or their a politician to say their view is more important than the woman's and the families that she belongs to, is just, you know, is just another indication that it's okay to diminish the woman's ability to make decisions for herself. But most importantly, politics is what is controlling here. And I would be remiss if I didn't remind people that the only way we're going to win, I agree with Michael, the only way we are going to win is to ensure that we elect politicians who are committed and are champions of individual rights and individual decision-making here. We have lots of elections coming up in Pennsylvania, and the governor's race, the legislative races are critical on this issue, and we ought to make sure the champions for reproductive choice are elected to all of those positions.
Let me get another caller to join us, and then I have one more clip to play from yesterday's arguments. This is Whitney calling us from Huntington Valley. Whitney, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add to the physical harm of abortions when performed by untrained doctors or lay people. My father in 1972, he was an obstetrician gynecologist then. A 19-year-old woman came to him, and she was pregnant. This was before Roe v. Wade. And he explained to her the problems of having an abortion from someone who was not trained. And eventually she and her boyfriend decided to have the child. Well, his father was a physician, like a family practice doctor, and ashamed of the situation, forced this young 19-year-old woman to have the baby, to abort the child. And she ended up sick for an entire year. He did the abortion himself.
Mm.
So he was, yes, the father of the boyfriend.
Oh, goodness.
So she was sick for a year and then could never have children. And the two of them ended up getting married anyway because they loved one another. It's just a tragic story. She could never have children. And my dad, you know, he worked for Planned Parenthood and always counseled people, of course, to the best of that he could without, he never gave his own opinion of what he thought about abortion, but just helping women with birth control and gynecological care. So it was a tragic story for sure.
Indeed. Whitney, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It's a little weird segue, but let me go back to actually to something that came up yesterday having to do with Roe and precedent. And I do want to play a clip from Brett Kavanaugh. This was during his Supreme Court confirmation hearing. This is 2018. And he was asked about his views on Roe v. Wade and repeatedly stated the importance of precedent. Let's give it a quick listen.
Roe v. Wade is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. It's been reaffirmed many times. It was reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992 when the court specifically considered whether to reaffirm it or whether to overturn it. In that case, in great detail. The three-justice opinion of Justice Kennedy, Justice Souter, and Justice O'Connor went through all the factors, the stare decisis factors, analyzed those, and decided to reaffirm Roe. That makes Casey precedent on precedent. It's been relied on. Casey itself has been cited as authority in subsequent cases, such as Glucksberg and other cases. So that precedent on precedent is quite important as you think about stare decisis in this context.
And then, Michael, and to you, Catherine, I wanted to play that because it is so frustrating. You know, we hear these confirmation hearings. There's Brett Kavanaugh basically upholding Roe, saying it's precedent on precedent, and yet we hear him yesterday. Go ahead.
Well, I think there, you know, he was describing the lay of the land clearly is that Casey reaffirmed Roe, although oddly by basically junking the whole core holding of Roe and coming up with a new test separately. But, you know, I think that in this decision recently involving this separate issue about whether jury verdicts had to be unanimous, he wrote a separate opinion talking about issues like, was the decision egregiously wrong in the first place? What kind of damage has it done to the court's jurisprudence and issues about reliance interests? And those are precisely the factors that I think the court will be grappling with in deciding how to resolve this. But, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, affirming separate but equal, was a 50-year precedent that the court reversed in Brown versus Board of Education, and rightly so.
You want to add to that, Catherine Colbert?
Well, you know, first, for Michael's example, Brown versus Board of Education expanded rights. It didn't contract them, and that is just the opposite of what would happen here should the court go and reverse these important decisions. But, you know, the problem is once a justice is confirmed to the court, they don't have to abide by anything they say. And there's nothing in Justice Kavanaugh's actions on the court so far that would lead me to believe that he would actually respect precedent here. Let's remember that five justices on this court already permitted, on two separate occasions, the Texas law to go into effect, which is contrary to precedent, right? Because both Roe and Casey says you have a right to abortion up until viability. So just in that, it gives us an indication that there's five votes to overrule Roe and Casey to permit states to again implement their political views over the women's interests. And, you know, I think that one of the problems here is that the people being proposed to be Supreme Court justices are reflecting a very not just conservative but ultra-conservative point of view being placed on the court for their views on this or other very highly contentious issues. Mm-hmm. And the reality is they never would have been even nominated to the court unless there had been some assurance that they would take this radical step.
And we're almost at a time. Then President Trump said he wanted anti-abortion justices. He got three, Michael Moreland.
Well, I don't think there's been any subterfuge here. Every Republican presidential candidate since Ronald Reagan has promised to do what he could to appoint justices to revisit Roe versus Wade and to and otherwise enact pro-life efforts. And so right. I mean, that the court has clearly shifted, but it has shifted in a way that was within the bounds of the Constitution. These were all, you know, people who were nominated and confirmed in the constitutional process, and we'll see how it plays out now in this context.
Indeed, we will. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Moreland, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a professor of law at Villanova University. Catherine Colbert, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. A co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights, director of the Athena Center for Leadership at Barnard College. She argued the Supreme Court Planned Parenthood v. Casey case back in 1992. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.